And I think, Samantha, you'll want to make Phil co-host.
Okay.
So if he needs to do any screen sharing. Jared, do you need to do any screen sharing?
No, I'm just going to wing it.
All right, winging it. Good. All right, 201. We will watch for some more folks as they join in the meeting. So this is our law session. I am going to just really let Jared and Phil do their own introductions, honestly. So why don't we start off with Jared? He's our current / outgoing LTC chair. And then he'll turn it over to Phil after that. So do use that hand-raising feature on there and chats if you have questions, and we'll try to call on folks. We should have plenty of time for questions and discussions at the end or even along the way. I think we have enough flexibility to be able to do that, but Samantha and I will try to pay attention to that as we go. Take away Jared.
Okay. So I was asked to just give a rundown of some legislative updates for Maine, some federal stuff, as well. And, a look at the horizon, just a brief look at the horizon. And then I'll turn it back over to Phil for some case studies. The LPC, the Maine LPC, there's a couple members that are on this, call. I see Maureen. I see Damon. There's some other people. The LPC meets during the session. We meet like every Friday at 9 a.m. So I don't know where the other Jared is, if he's still around. That's what you're in for, buddy. It's a good time. It's a really good group. I think the LPC, you know, from an advocacy standpoint, if we're doing advocacy, we take an educational posture when we testify in front of the legislature, when we submit comments to a committee, we try to take a educational posture on most of our positions. Two bills that were still live until November that the LPC testified on, LD 1956, that was to establish a commission to increase housing opportunities by studying zoning and land use restrictions. That one's dead on that conclusion of the 129th legislature on November 16th. MAP supported that, but that one's dead. And then the other one out of two, LD 1141, that was to get the Maine DOT to construct a Merry Meeting Trail from Topsom to Gardner. MAP supported that one, and it's dead, deceased, gone. I wanted to mention that, you know, the Climate Council was a big part of what the MAP LPC paid attention to over the last year. And the Maine Association of Planners as a whole paid attention to that. At the beginning of the meeting, I noticed, you know, there was some discussion. There's some new people in Maine. So I'll give a little background on what the Climate Council is all about. June 26, 2019, the governor passed LD 1679. It was an emergency bill. And that was an act to promote clean energy jobs and establish the Maine Climate Council. Now, what that is, that they basically dusted off a law from 2003, and made some changes, some updates for today, and included the Maine Climate Council, so forming the Maine Climate Council. So if you want to see the law, if you want to nerd out and go see the law, that's at 38 Maine Revised Statute, Section 577A. Basically, the Climate Council is charged with a four-year plan for state climate action, and that was due December 1st. Now, they issued their report on December 1st, and it's about 120 pages, and it's a very attractive report. You know, it's a nice-looking report with a lot of interesting information. The idea with this new law is that they would plan out greenhouse gas emission reductions with goals set for 2030, 2040, and 2050, and they would provide an annual greenhouse gas report to the legislature. So MAP hosted a video conference to develop some recommendations for the Climate Council, and we submitted a letter signed by the MAP president, Samantha signed it, with three primary recommendations. That went out May 8th, 2020. The three recommendations for MAP were to provide flexible ways for communities to do climate action planning, to strengthen the role of regional and state planning organizations. And the third recommendation was to provide climate action planning incentives. And if you want to see that letter, it's posted on the NECAPA page. You go to the main section, you see the policy section on the NECAPA page, and you can see that testimony, the letter that we sent. So what's next? As I said, that December 1st report was just posted. You got the governor's office of policy and innovation in the future issuing this very nice report for the working with the Climate Council. But if you don't want to review the whole big, long report, you could peruse the 17-page implementation chart, you know, and that's kind of a snapshot of what's on the horizon. If you're going to fast forward and drill down even farther than that, if 17 pages is too much for you, skip ahead to page 14. On page 14 of that implementation chart, you'll see a couple of items pertaining to updating land use regulations, laws, and practices by 2024. You know, that's where MAP probably needs to focus some attention. A couple of other dates to be aware of, beginning January 15th, 2021, and annually thereafter, all sources of funding for the Climate Council must be reported to the Energy, Environment and Natural Resources Committee for the previous year, and at that time, any proposed legislation may be included in that report. So the ENR is to report out legislation to implement any recommendation contained in the Climate Council's report. Again, that's January 15th, 2021. So pay attention to that. By July 1st, 2021, the DEP, the Department of Environmental Protection, shall adopt rules to track and report the legislature on gross annual greenhouse gas emissions and net annual greenhouse gas emissions. And by September 1st, 2021, the Board of Environmental Protection, shall adopt rules to ensure compliance with greenhouse gas reductions at those 10-year benchmarks that I mentioned before. So the rules that are laid out in this law, the climate action plan, consistency is required. So look at that December 1st plan, which is a very nice plannery thing to do. You know, consistency is always good. You have, and they are also required to look at the different sectors that report greenhouse gas emissions through the U.S. Energy Information Administration and the DEP biennial reports. And I should mention, I'm reading off of a note page that I've given to Amanda. So if anybody wants these links, any of these dates and things, it's only a couple of pages. Maybe that could be handed out, but I have links to this information. So for these rules, you get credit for existing greenhouse gas reductions. You can credit voluntary measures to sequester additional carbon in forest, farms, and coastal lands in Maine, or the use of materials that sequester additional carbon. And the Maine DOT may adopt rules after consulting with DEP to ensure compliance with emission levels. Now, I mention all this rulemaking because the state statute sets these up to be routine technical rules, which basically means they don't have to go in front of the legislature to adopt these rules. So you'll want to pay attention to the department's rulemaking page to see what's coming down for rulemaking, and that'll make the next LPC chair's life a little bit more interesting because they're not just going to be looking at the legislative page. They're also going to have to focus on the rulemaking pages. But anyway, those are routine technical rules. So that's what I have for the Climate Council regs. Some federal stuff to be aware of that I thought was noteworthy. The Army Corps just released the 2020 Maine General Permit update in October. It's a really long read, but you know, if you need a sleep aid or something, read that thing. It'll put you to sleep. I noticed a couple of things that I thought were kind of interesting. Living shorelines are now noted as a preferred shoreline erosion management practice to riprap and bulkheads. I've been doing a lot of work with living shorelines in Brunswick, and the Climate Council noted them in some of their reporting, so it was really nice to see that the new GP prefers those to other shoreline erosion management techniques. And I also noticed that vernal pools, the old adjacency standards that that they used to have, that was a 2010 GP, they had a 750 jurisdictional buffer around vernal pools. So if you impact waters in the United States, and then they find a vernal pool in the project, then they had jurisdiction within 750 feet. And the new 2020 GP, there's no adjacency. So there's no more 750 foot adjacency in the new 2020 GP, which is kind of interesting. There's another thing that maybe municipalities want to pay attention to. You can adopt a special area management plan for exemption to GP permits for filling vernal pools. The state of Maine has a similar program. You know, if you sort of plan for mitigation and protection measures for vernal pools, if you're going to impact them in the growth zone, if you protect them in the rural zone, there's a program set up like that in the state of Maine. So it's interesting to see some consistency between what the state's doing and what the feds have in their GP. The Digital Coast Act, a lot of planners use that for sea level rise projections, flooding, storm surge, that kind of thing. The Digital Coast Act's made it through Congress. They're working out some things, and it should, you know, land on the president's desk for approval. That's kind of a neat thing because it would come with a funding option. I don't know exactly how it works, but it seems like NOAA would have the option to charge if they wanted to, so they'd have a sustainable funding for that program. And one of the last things for federal stuff, the CARES Act. Everybody's aware of the CARES Act. That provided some aid for communities. There's a neat page that the American Planning Association put together that lays out all the emergency aid that you can get to help your community through, you know, COVID-19 and economic downturn, et cetera, and so forth. And I put a link in my notes to that, you know, that resource from APA. And, you know, as far as federal stuff, APA is still pushing for federal stimulus, but, you know, who knows when that'll come. If you're reading the papers lately, I mean, who really knows? The 130th legislature, in a snapshot, because that's really all we have right now, 130th Maine State Legislature convened first regular session on December 2nd, so just this week. The legislature will adjourn on June 16th, 2021, so it should be interesting. So far, the list of bills, I saw some administrative bills about COVID-19 safety and transparency, you know, no land use stuff, nothing substantive. So I have to kick us off.
Sounds good. All right.
My turn?
I think so.
Okay. Thank you guys for having me back. It was fun last year, a little different this year. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Phil Saucier. I'm the chair of the municipal department at Bernstein Shore. I work with a lot of you guys. My main job is to work with planners and town managers and co-enforcement officers, zoning boards, and my role as municipal attorney. So it's always fun to do this with you guys. I gave you a handout which summarized really all the municipal cases this year. There were 10 of them that our Maine Supreme Court decided from December when I start this till about a month ago. And I do that every year for the Lawyers Association, the Maine Bar Association. I provide them a municipal update. This is more fun to talk to you guys because you guys actually know what these things mean. And unlike the lawyers, you guys are working with the ordinances every day and the and from a practical perspective and the boards. I'm not going to go through all 10 of these cases. I'm only going to pick out 4 of them, I think, that are of more relevance to you. But I thought you'd find them all interesting, so I just included the whole packet. Before I get into that, and I wanted to thank Jared on that update. I didn't have anything really either because, as Jared mentioned, it was a really shortened session. I did skim the bills, and there were really nothing of consequence for the planning community this session that passed. There was one small dangerous building tweak, but nothing really in the planning world. I mean, I'm going to touch upon a bill from last year that comes up in one of these cases, but nothing there. A couple observations. Two things that I spent most of my time with this year. First, the COVID emergency law and associated executive orders, which of course you guys have all probably done by having virtual meetings. That was something I spent a significant amount of time on this year, just interpreting those and helping planning boards and planners and town councils work their way through that. But also marijuana, I'll just say that continues to be the number one topic that I am asked questions about from planners, planning boards, and code enforcement officers. It continues to be a hot topic, particularly since the state has started issuing their licenses. And so there's a lot of activity. And I guess I just want to point out one thing, and I'm sure you guys have all dealt with this, but I think the thing I'm getting the most questions on is this issue of medical marijuana cultivation. And the reason why is because it's really a category that is not fully dealt with in the statutes. And I know you guys all know this, but there are four categories of marijuana establishments under both the adult use and the medical marijuana law. And municipalities have to opt in now before they're allowed. And, under the adult use law, there is a category called cultivation facilities. But there is not such a category for medical marijuana. Instead, it's caregivers who are growing, and caregivers are allowed to grow. Municipalities can't limit the number or prohibit caregivers from their community, but they can regulate them. But there is no such category as a cultivation facility, and it's a pretty big business, is what I'm learning. They're popping up all over the state, and they look like, what an adult use cultivation facility would be. They're either in buildings or their buildings are enclosed facilities, fairly large in some cases. It's a business. So without proper regulatory tools in your land use ordinance, they usually just fall under agriculture or commercial greenhouse or some other use that's not prohibited. And so that's in certain communities, it depends on the community, that causes a lot of consternation. So I've seen a lot of moratoria in that area this year or helped meet all municipalities draft ordinances that would create a new land use category called medical marijuana cultivation facility or sometimes called production facility. Municipalities are allowed to do that, and then they can zone them, create performance standards, license those kinds of facilities, that sort of thing. But until you have that in your ordinance, they can really be fairly unregulated. And so that's something that I've really seen a lot of this year, a lot of activity in that area. The only real observation, the second observation for you, the cases is that, and you guys know this, is that the building community has been busy. So even though we've been in COVID and meeting virtually through these meetings, planning board's been very busy and code enforcement officers have been very busy issuing building permits. Our work has not slowed down. In fact, I think it's somehow increased from a year ago. So the regular kind of day-to-day work of reviewing these decisions, having them appealed in some cases, continues apace. And I'm going to just jump right in because that's where we usually see cases is once they're appealed, and all of these are in that kind of context. So I'm going to first talk about Grant versus the town of Belgrade. And this is a case, non-conforming use case, so a grandfathering case in a shoreland zone. And in this case, it was a gentleman who had three non-conforming lots along the water. One was across the street, and two are right on the water in Belgrade. And he had a home occupation permit at one point, in 2008, to do some boat cleaning and painting and varnishing. But that business had, as they tend to do sometimes, expanded well beyond the scope of what he had his home occupation permit for, to include things like boat rentals, slips, paddle boards. He had put docks in and people were accessing the docks. It was really a mini marina, if you will. I mean, those are my words, but it was that kind of use in launch small watercraft. So at some point, and I'm not sure when that was, he applied for his new permit. So, I think that was obviously he knew he needed to do that. There was likely going to be some enforcement action. So he came in for sort of an after the fact approval under the town's commercial development review ordinance and shoreland zoning ordinance. There was also another ordinance involved, and it's sort of a practice pointer, called the minimum lot size ordinance. Belgrade is the town we represent. Actually, I didn't take this case. One of my ex-colleagues had it, but they don't have a typical zoning ordinance. So you have these kind of pieces of ordinances put together. That can be one of the issues. And they had slightly different language on how you can use non-conforming lots. And that's the key issue in this case. So, getting back to his permit, the planning board denied his permit to sort of legalize the uses that he had today, because it failed to meet the minimum lot standards. And the Board of Appeals upheld that decision. When it got to the court, and the Superior Court also upheld it, when it got to the law court, Grant was arguing that this was not a new commercial use, that he had continued the commercial use he had under his home occupation permit, and that they misinterpreted the shoreline zoning ordinance when they concluded the property was subject to the shoreline zoning dimensional requirements. So he was saying that he was legally nonconforming and could continue that use. The law court disagreed, and it's really an ordinance interpretation question, and you'll see these in some of your ordinances, obviously, where you don't have consistency. So in one provision of the shoreline zoning ordinance, it read, and I'm just going to read the relevant provisions, a nonconforming lot may be built upon, without the need of a variance, and exempted lot area, shore frontage, and minimum lot width requirements. Typical grandfather. But then another provision said no building structure or land use or change in use can be erected except in conformity with the regulations herein, and that non-conforming conditions that existed before the deadline are allowed to continue, except, quote, a non-conforming condition shall not become permitted to become more non-conforming. And then finally, in the minimum lot size ordinance, there was a provision that said the use of a non-conforming lot existing on the effective day of the ordinance may not be changed to any other use for which the lot would be less conforming under the ordinance. So that's what the court was grappling with, those four different provisions. Some of them are similar, but the first one I read was different, which just simply said a lot can be built upon, even if it didn't meet these four dimensional standards. The law court ultimately said, no, you have to read this all together. And what this gentleman was seeking to do, or had already done, was expand. It was a commercial use. Commercial uses required quite a larger lot area and more shore frontage than a residential use, which is what he had before with his home occupation permit. And so that was an expansion of the nonconforming use. And it was not grandfathered, and you had to read the ordinance together, which is another sort of tenet of municipal law. You're looking at provisions that could be inconsistent, or you're trying to find the meaning of an ordinance. You really have to read the ordinance as a totality and come to conclusions that are not irrational, in the words of the court, or that make sense. You look at the ordinance to make sure that it reads in harmony. So that's what the court was doing here. It also sort of just, I think, and you'd appreciate this, it ended by just saying, and let's just remember one of the reasons why we're coming to this conclusion here is that at the end of the day, the principle of a zoning ordinance is to generally abolish nonconforming conditions. That's the goal of a zoning ordinance, and that's why variances are so difficult to get under the standards of the day. So having that as the guiding principle when you're interpreting a zoning ordinance, particularly the nonconforming sections, will lead to this conclusion. And what the court said is, and this was, I don't know if it's new, but it was a new glean on it, is they said zoning provisions that restrict nonconformities are going to be liberally construed, while zoning provisions that allow nonconformities are strictly construed. And that's what they're going to do. And I think that is consistent with past law, but this is as clear as they've made it. So that's guidance for us when we're looking at provisions, and there's a question about whether a nonconforming use can be allowed or not. You'll look to see whether it's a restriction or an allowance provision, and then you would provide the correct standard. In this case, the court found that grandfathering clauses, such as those in the town's ordinances that allow landowners to continue reasonable investment-backed expectations they had when they bought their properties, but they do not permit expansions or changes to nonconforming conditions indefinitely. So I think that's sort of a good overview of those principles. And I'm happy to take questions as we go along if you want, or at the end, but that was all I have on that case. The second case is interesting. And it's really an appeal case. It's a procedure case. But we talked about last year, I think it was May, we met. Natalie and I talked about a new law about the when decisions can be appealed. This is a case called Friends of Lemoyne versus the Town of Lemoyne. At the end of the day, this is a case about, which I'm not going to really get into the details of what they were applying for here, but it was a gravel operation, and it was existing gravel operation. And the application was to expand the gravel operation. Those are always, you know, fun ones, and people get excited about those applications. There was a friends group that didn't like it, so the gravel operation actually got their permits from the planning board, but the Board of Appeals reviewed it and overturned the decisions. Of the planning board, there were two ordinances. There was a site plan review ordinance and a gravel ordinance. It was the opposite. So the planning board denied it. The Board of Appeals sent it back to the planning board to issue the permits. Remanded it back. And then it went up to the court. The issue here is when the first issue, and this is the only thing that really matters for this case, I think, for our purposes, is when it was the applicable appeal period. You had the zoning board decision. Under the state law, there's a 45-day rule from a zoning board to the Superior Court. But then it went back to the planning board, and in that case, the zoning board made the planning board do something, right? They made them issue a permit as part of the remand. And that's what the friends group appealed from. And one of the first arguments was that it was too late, that they didn't appeal the zoning board determination within the 45 days. And so it was too late. And one thing, what the court said here is, and I'm going to get into this as a sort of a sidebar, is that no, it was actually because the last decision, if you will, was the planning board's determination, even though it was sort of this strange remand decision, that was the decision that was the operative decision for purposes of the appeal period. And so it was timely appealed. I want to just talk quick about this because this was the first time the court had interpreted a new law that outlined this new appeal procedure. And I mentioned it last year, but I think it's worth revisiting because it's a little complicated and quite frankly, not at all confident it's going to be the last iteration of the statute as we sort of see it play out. There was a case you may remember called Bryant versus the Town of Camden that I spoke about, which was a number three or four years ago at this point, which for the first time the law court held in the case of a hotel that was trying to expand in Camden. It needed a special exception from the Zoning Board of Appeals and a site plan approval from their planning board. So the hotel people went to the Board of Appeals. They got their special exception. They were in the middle of the site plan review process, but there was an appeal of that zoning board determination for a special exception. Made its way up to the law court. The law court said, wait a minute, why is this here? We're sick of piecemeal appeals, is literally what they said. They didn't say sick of it, but they basically did. And they asked towns to go back and take a look at their ordinances, and they don't want to see all this municipal litigation that's been piecemeal. So instead, they're only going to hear appeals if it's a, quote, final municipal decision. Now, we didn't know what that was. And there's a statute that they did not decide to abrogate, the zoning board statute, which specifically says there are appeals from a decision of a zoning board must be taken within 45 days of the vote of the decision. So regardless of that statute, the court held that they would not be hearing appeals anymore from zoning boards of appeals if it was not the final municipal decision as part of a project. Maybe it makes sense from an efficiency point of view, but it sort of blew the legal minds. We didn't know what to do with that. And in fact, there was a little bit of craziness that happened right afterwards because, and I don't blame them, but plaintiff's lawyers or people who didn't like decisions didn't know what to do because you had a statute saying you had to appeal. You didn't want to lose your chance to appeal, but you had this law court decision. And so people started filing what we were calling Bryant motions. So they would actually still appeal the zoning board, but then file a motion to say, you can stay this. You should stay this in light of Bryant. We just want to preserve our rights to appeal. because we got to still go back to the planning board and we're not done. It's not a final decision. So there was some confusion. So a few of us got together and drafted a ordinance, including some from MAP. There were a few planners as part of this sort of ad hoc group that we pulled together to try to, even if you disagreed with the decision, we just were hoping to codify it. So there was something in statute for, so that there would be a blueprint for how this should actually work. So there's a new statute. We got that done. It was very ad hoc. In fact, we all worked together. I got my local representative here in Cape Elizabeth to sponsor it. And then we realized that we were all doing this for the first time and no one was going to be there. So I hopped in my truck the day of the public hearing because the legislature would not have understood this bill. There's no doubt about it. It was a complicated situation. So I ended up testifying just on my own behalf just to try to explain what we were doing here. It's in 30A 4482-A. And what that statute did is, again, try to codify the Bryant case. It's 4482-A and-D. And what the case said is a finality of municipal land use decision. A municipal land use decision is a final decision when it's received all of its required municipal administrative approvals by a board. We purposely said that because one of the questions that came out of Bryant was, well, what does it mean to get your last permit? Right? There are plumbing permits and electrical permits and building permits for that matter. And there's all kinds of different permits that a project gets, and it didn't seem reasonable or rational to require a developer or a homeowner for that matter to go through the entire process if it was just going to be appealed and spend the money, for example, the construction documents, for example, further down the road that you would do typically later on. So it was limited to any kind of board approval. And then after it gets each of its board approval, then the decision is ripe for appeal. We did recognize though that you should have the right to appeal if you get a denial along the way. Because it wouldn't make sense to get a denial, for example, from the Board of Appeals for a special exception and then require that person to still go to the planning board, if that denial was going to be upheld. So there we are. It's a little complicated. It's not as neat as I'd like it to be, but it codified what the law court wanted to have happen. So this case, was the first time the court had interpreted that statute. And that's the import of this case. And then they found sort of a little wrinkle at the end of the day was that if you have a remand and a board does something on that remand, that is now the final decision. That was sort of a long way of talking about that new law, but I think it's an important thing. And there's still going to be some confusion, no doubt, as people go through a process and they have to figure out if they should be appealing or not. Next case is called Raposa versus Town of York. And I actually talked, this is the second time it's gone to the law court. Our firm was involved in this case, full disclosure. This is an interesting case. Last year, you may remember the issue on that case. This was a case about a neighbor not liking a decision of a code officer, finding that a use was a continuing use. It was continued to be grandfathered when there was a commercial use going on for many years, a legally non-conforming commercial use. Someone bought the property, continued a commercial use, but changed it somewhat. From an excavation, it was an excavation business, and the new use was a landscaping kind of company. The code officer found no violation, and that it was, quote-unquote, grandfathered. And the neighbors appealed that decision. And all the way up through the process, the board held it was not an appealable decision because there was no decision, right? It was a determination. It was a type of determination, but it was a determination that there was no violation. And what the law court said is, in that first case, no. So now we all know that a decision that there is no violation is also appealable. That was what Raposa 1 held. Unless your ordinance or charter says otherwise. So you can kind of opt out of that. That harkens back to a case called Elliott Shores versus the Town of Elliott from about, that was actually the first law court case I worked on when I joined Bernstein Shear back in 2010, where sort of out of the blue in that case, that was just a typical enforcement case. And it made its way all the way through. The town had, brought an enforcement action against an illegal subdivision. They won all along the way. It got to it was an appeal of a notice of violation. Ultimately, is what got it to the law court. The law court, instead of addressing the substance of the issues, decided on their own in this Elliot Shores case, without briefing or oral argument on the issue, that it was not, they shouldn't have been funded in the first place, because notices of violation are advisory only and not appealable, and they don't take advisory cases. That changed a lot of people's views, thoughts on the whole process. And we went back again. That also resulted in a legislative amendment. And now the statute, you guys are probably familiar with this, says that, notice of violation are, appealable unless you say otherwise. So it's sort of the opposite of that. You can opt out. And so the law court, sort of in a funny little twist, and they've recognized this in other cases, that they were essentially overruled by the legislature when the legislature added that language. And the reason why it was considered advisory, by the way, in Elliot Shores, is because there has to be another step after that, right? So a code officer says it's a notice of violation, but the next step is an actual enforcement action, an ADK enforcement action. And typically either a town manager or a board of selectmen or a town council has to make that determination. And there's prosecutorial discretion. So that was the law court's thinking there, that this is really not an appealable event, because the town could decide not to bring an enforcement action, if you will, under their enforcement discretion. So the law was changed to sort of overturn that. This was the law court saying, okay, fine. Then decisions of no violation are also appealable under that new statute. So that's what Raposa 1 said. And so you should think about that, whether you want that for your community or not. Because I think it can tee up, I could see sort of abutter cases and things like that where you could tee up, questions to the code officer. The code officer has to say no, and then that starts sort of a litigation process. Now this is now Raposa 2, less interesting. It's back up to the court because after it went down, sort of interesting. Ultimately, what the Board of Appeals did is they, quote, granted the appeal of the neighbor on, and they said, yes, we grant your appeal on some of these issues about whether there was a violation. However, when they wrote their decision, they wrote it in a way that didn't grant it. So they found no violation. This was really just, some inconsistent language happening during a meeting. They clearly intended to find for the current lawful nonconforming owner, but they granted the appeal, and it led to some consistency. What was the real decision? What happened orally or the written decision? Interestingly enough, the court said, "Well, we don't know. It's inconsistent, so we're going to send it back. And I want you to really tell me for real this time what you meant." There was one Justice Mead, who's the acting chief right now, dissented, saying, no, we should look at the written decision. And the written decision was supported by substantial evidence. They may have been, not careful in their wording when they were discussing this orally. But that's what we would have done. But that's another good example to make sure you have clear findings, at the planning board or zoning board. If there's any kind of question like that, where it sounds like someone may be saying something different than what the written decision is, you should have that clarified right off the bat and catch those kinds of things, because it was a good example of some good lawyering and ultimately got it pushed back. We represented the town in that, by the way. So both cases, it was sent back. We were on the town side. The last case is the sort of most befuddling to me. And okay, the second question I get more than marijuana is, questions related to deed restrictions and homeowners association and can towns enforce those? You know, that's the kind of question I get a lot, and I'm sure you guys do too. This case is about that kind of thing, but it comes to a conclusion that is different than I would have thought. And this is one I actually recommend you reading. It's called Tomasino versus the Town of Casco. And in this case, the Tomasinos had obtained a building permit from the town of Casco to remove an existing home from the property and create a new home. as well as a shoreland permit to remove three trees from the abutting property owned by a trust, over which they had a deeded easement, so they had an easement to get to the property, but they wanted a new gravel road. And to get that, to make the new gravel road, they needed to remove three trees. They got a permit. The trust said, you don't have a right to remove the trees. The easement doesn't give you that right. So it's really a deed interpretation issue. In this case, the Board of Appeals agreed that they did not have the correct, that the easement was unclear, essentially, as to the right of the parties to cut the trees without the other party's permission, and therefore that they did not have standing or right, title, and interest for the permit, and so it was denied. Typically, what I would have said in that case is, and then it went up to the law court. Typically, if I was advising a town, I would say, as long as they have, based on prior case law, as long as someone presents a valid deed that purports to give someone the right to do something that they're asking for, you should not be looking into underlying and interpreting deeds. That's not your role or responsibility. The court in this case essentially said that too and quoted all the case law that underlies the statement I just made, but came to the opposite conclusion in this case on the facts of this particular case. And the case law, what the case law really says, and again, the majority opinion, there was a really long minority opinion, which doesn't happen very often in our law courts. And that's what I'd really recommend you reading this case, is that determining property rights under a deed are, quote, well outside the board's jurisdiction, authority, or expertise, which is instead limited to the interpretation and application of ordinance provisions, and that a municipal zoning case is not the proper forum for a private property dispute between neighbors. That's the principle here. The law is well established that restrictive covenants in a deed as to the use of a property are distinct and separate from the provisions of the zoning law that have no influence or part in the administration of zoning laws. Typically what I will say, and sometimes we even include it as a note on a plan, if there's an issue raised, I have language that I've suggested the planning boards use, which is that planning board has neither the authority nor the jurisdiction to determine private property disputes, which is instead something for the courts, through a private contractual matter. The towns are not party to these agreements, and we have no part. The courts have been clear about that. But in this case, the court said the Board of Appeals is right in this case. The easement that was presented did not give them the, quote, kind of relationship to the site that gives them a legally cognizable expectation of having the power to use the site in the ways that would be authorized by the permit or license they seek. That's the standard. And so what the court did is it did look into the deed. And I think it upheld the decision of the local board that did just that, right? So the board essentially made a determination that the deed was insufficient for the purposes, or at least there was a question about whether the applicant had the right. And so what the court concluded ultimately, and I think this is how we're going to see this play out, is that in the face of a dispute between private property owners, the minimum right, title, or interest requirement in the CASCO ordinance in this case is not met by an easement whose parameters have not been factually determined by a court with jurisdiction to do so. What that means practically is if there's a question raised, if a neighbor, right, an abutter who has a property interest in that easement, so maybe they're the underlying survey, they're the servient estate or the dominant estate, they are arguing with you as a town. What this case is saying is you have to wait for them to present you a court case that determines it. Otherwise, it's not sufficient right, title, and interest. So we'll see what this does. I mean, I think it has a lot of, we'll see how the lawyers sort of use this case, opponents to projects and things like that, because I think there's one way of reading this case to limit it to the facts in this particular case. There are others that have a broader application. So if there was ever a dispute, you could sort of try to stop the process right off the bat if you're one of the owners of the easement. Justice Connors, who's one of the newest justices on the court, wrote that, dissent. And she says, while, she agreed with the majority that a municipal zoning case is not the proper forum for a private property dispute between neighbors, and questions of property, private property law are outside of municipal board's jurisdiction, she disagreed with the holding and would have held that they had sufficient right, title, and interest to seek a permit. And instead, you know, from the municipal perspective, because again, we're only applying our rules. We're not applying the private, we're not interpreting private contractual rules. They're still made, the Tomasinos under that analysis, under the way I would have looked at it before this case, still might not be able to do what they want to do if someone brings a private dispute. And that's what happens in, you know, homeowners associations frequently. There may be a restriction in the homeowners documents and what you can do, but that doesn't have any impact on what you can do under the town zoning ordinances. And you'd have a different enforcement, measure. But what she said, I think, and this is the worry, is that she worried that the court's holding, quote, invites rather than discourages municipal boards to wade into private property disputes and will result in needlessly protracted proceedings involving squabbling neighbors. And create unnecessary conflict by forcing easement holders to actively litigate the scope of easements before seeking what might have otherwise been unchallenged permits. That was the dissent. So we'll keep an eye on this, but it will come up in planning boards as we go forward, and I don't know yet the impact. So those are the only four cases I was going to highlight today. There are six others in there that are, if you're interested in more broader municipal law principles that were decided this year, issues of standing on when people can, when someone has the standing to challenge an ordinance, in that case in Bar Harbor. There is a case in Cape Elizabeth about paper streets. The tort claims case, the consent decree case, and one or two others. But that's all I had really from the planning side of it, and happy to answer any questions you guys might have.
So I'll just keep an eye here on the chat, and if anyone has a question, go ahead and raise your hand and we'll recognize you.
Sorry, Phil, could you list those cases again that you said that you haven't talked about?
Yeah. And I don't know, did you circulate the written materials I sent earlier? And if you
didn't,
just
did.
You
I okay. Forgot to beforehand, so we kind of got it happening while you were talking.
Okay, not a problem. Yeah,
everybody
I should have
received an email with your handout in the last half hour.
Okay.
I'm personally interested in number nine, the incipient dedication of a road.
Sure.
I don't know if you could.
Well, Maureen can probably talk about it more than I can, but no, I'm happy
all
to.
All about this, too, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Another snake.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to talk briefly about this. I'm not going to get into all the details here, but from the paper street perspective, how that works and what the court said here. There were a couple different challenges. If you don't know, I guess I'll say a bit. Maureen, please correct me. I haven't been up on this case, even though I'm very well aware of it, as it's a local case for me. This is a case about a paper street in Cape Elizabeth along the waterfront, but you know, a road that showed up on a recorded subdivision plan that was never built, but it's been used by people walking. But also has been used in some cases by the abutting property owners as part of essentially their yard. And the court kind of outlines these facts. And in some cases, there's staircases or fireplaces or other kinds of things that have sort of crept into the paper street over the years. It's their backyard, right up abutting it, technically their backyard. But it was a, The town, and you may know this, under common law, the public had a right to accept these paper streets through a concept called incipient dedication. So once a subdivision plan is recorded in the registry of deeds, a municipality has the right to accept those as public ways. There was a common law for how long, we don't know. but there was probably an outer limit. It was one of these things that was a case by case factual basis until the legislature stepped in and enacted a law, which you guys probably all know, the sort of paper street law, which really came about because the title bar, there's a lot of old streets, paper streets in Maine, and the title bar, real estate bar, really wanted a way to help clean it up, essentially, because there's all these sort of rights out there in these ways. And so what the statute said is, well, going forward, it's not a problem anymore, because a proposed unaccepted way is deemed to have been vacated within 15 years if it hasn't been used. But everything before that time would go over 20 years. You could file something in the Registry of Deeds to give yourself as a municipality an initial 20 years to accept the paper street. The Town of Cape Elizabeth did that in this case, and then it filed an additional 20-year period when that came up. And so at the end of the day, I thought this was a pretty simple case. It's clearly got some, there's always emotion around it. But at the end of the day, really, it was about what this was put on the town's paper street list that was recorded in the Registry of Deeds to exempt it from being deemed vacated, otherwise losing the ability to accept these roads. And the town properly did it within the time period the court held. And so, that street was not deemed vacated, and the town still has the ability to potentially accept it. What the court did find, I thought was sort of interesting, is that they punted on a second count. It was not ripe for review, is what they said. And that was a question about whether or not the town can accept the way in something other than what it was intended to be, like a road. Could it accept it as a trail? Or some other type of thing, and the court said, "Well, that's we don't know because the town hasn't done anything yet. We'll see that case in the future, probably." And right now, they just have the right to accept it, and that's what we're holding that they still do have the right to accept it. Let's see what they do. So there's still a little bit of a unknown here in the case, but at least as it relates to count one, I think it was a pretty straightforward case in that what essentially said is as long as a town has put their paper streets on the list in the registry in accordance with the procedures in the statute, you hold on to that ability and they were not deemed vacated under the common law principles. That's a quick and dirty of that one. There's a lot more to it in terms of the facts of this particular case. And Maureen is going to jump in.
Well, for anyone who doesn't think there's drama in planning, one of the debates was whether or not people are actually walking in this area. And at one point, the attorney representing the town said, "Don't you have anything?" I said, "I don't have anything. There's nothing." And you know, even our aerial photos that we take today in 2017, you can't see trails on the ground. The only time I've ever seen it is in a scrubby area. And then we stopped. And I went back into our dusty, no kidding, attic with our huge old 1951 black and white aerial photos. And one end of the paper street is actually a shorefront scrubby area, and you could see trails on it. So there was the drama. And just so we're clear, that aerial photo is now in our vault.
So that's that case, Amanda just wanted me to read off briefly what the other ones were. I'm not going to go into it, but if someone has a question, let me know. But the other ones, and what I do every year is we have this, the Maine State Bar Association has something called the Legal Year in Review, which is a two-day conference, and someone takes each topic. I've been doing the municipal law one, that's my fourth year, and I literally just go through the case, and I found every case with a town or a city in it, and that's how I find it out. So there are 10 of them this year. These are ones I didn't talk about, and I'll just give one sentence or two. Blanchard versus the town of Bar Harbor. That was a case about cruise ships. It was a cruise ship case, and the town had adopted an ordinance that would allow cruise ships to dock at the town's deck, passenger terminal there, and some neighbors had sued, and they find it wasn't ripe for it, and it was, they also did not have standing. It was a bunch of people in that harbor and Sorrento and Hancock and Bar Harbor and the whole area there, and you don't have standing. They didn't have standing. The other case was Bolton versus the town of Scarborough. This is a case that our firm has been involved in for many, many years. It finally, I think, concluded. It was in a tax assessment case out down on Prout's Neck, which has been going on for a very long time, but I finally concluded, and there was a decision in that case. Town of Gorham versus Duchesne was sufficiency of evidence to support a ruling on a motion to enforce the consent decree. The only sort of takeaway from that was there was a consent decree in a land use enforcement case that had certain, you know, timelines. The offender didn't comply, and so the town went to enforce it, which would have sort of resurrected penalties and other remedies that were put on hold as part of the consent decree. And what the court said actually in this case is they sent it back because the town needed to put more evidence in the record. If you're going to do that kind of thing, you have to have affidavits. You should probably have a hearing. And the district court just simply signed it and said, yeah, there was a violation of the consent decree. And this person has to pay the fees. So it was really an evidentiary type of case, consent decrees. If you want a fun one, MSAD number 6, Board of Directors for the town of Frye Island. That's fun in the sense that it's an interesting case where the town of Frye Island has been trying to withdraw from the school administrative units and part of ever since it seceded from the town of Windham. And I'm sorry, Standish. They seceded as part of the deal. It was that they would not leave the school unit, but then almost immediately after they were able to secede to the legislature, they then tried to start to withdraw. And this is like case number whatever 10 of this. It's just an ongoing battle. But it's an interesting case at the end of the day of preemption. And when the state law preempts municipal decisions, the part that I thought was fun, not funny, is that there is a state law, a private and special law that prescribes how Frye Island can withdraw, and it requires another act of the legislature. And Frye Island decided to amend their charter to say that private and special law was now superseded by their own charter, and the court said you can't do that.
Phil, so we did have Beth was wanting you to speak to that case. So Beth, was that enough, or would you like to hear more about that on some particular point?
I can get into more detail too. Yeah.
No, I'm fine. That's kind of what I wanted to hear.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
What it's a good case for, if you're looking for, it's a good case that lays out preemption principles. So if you're thinking about preemption issues, it does. Lay out those principles. It's a good one to go to, and at least cites the prior cases. So that's, I think, what that one is helpful for. We talked about Lemoyne and Raposa and Tomasino and Pilot Point. The last case is probably not really, it's a Maine Tort Claims Act case, McDonald versus the City of Portland. The Maine Tort Claims Act obviously comes up a lot in municipal law, and it's really whether there's liability or not under the Maine Tort Claims Act. In this case, where someone fell in the plaza outside of the Portland Police Department. And so it's a case really about whether that plaza is part of the building or not. And if you know that, it all sort of is a building. The plaza is actually the roof of a parking garage. And so the court said, yes, it is part of the building, and thus could be potentially liable. The city could be potentially liable for a slip in that area. Those were all of the cases this year that I could find.
Great. Any more questions from anyone? And if there's nothing specific on the cases that Phil raised, if there are other questions that relate to law this past year generally for either Jared or Phil, we can go a little broader too. Ben put a comment in the chat or question. Phil stated earlier towns can regulate marijuana cultivation, but can municipalities regulate location of medical caregivers by zone?
So what I would say to that is I do think there's a distinction between caregivers that are growing for their own patients and households versus patient caregivers that are growing off site, in other words, not in their house at a commercial location or a non-residential location. There is a little bit of, you need to be a little bit of careful if you're trying to just regulate caregivers generally, because caregivers can grow for their own household and family members without any kind of permit or registration from the state. And so what I've generally said, if it's that type of thing going on, I would not regulate that by zone. You can still potentially have some other performance standards, you know, buffering or things like that. But I would leave that alone. Where I think you can regulate, and there's a lot of authority to do so, is if really what they're doing is running a business and they are a registered caregiver, meaning it's not just for their household or family member, and it's more of a business. And so that's what you can regulate by zone. And most towns that I've worked with that have decided to go in that direction have created a new category, as I said, land use category, put it in the table of uses, and went that direction. So that's the distinction I would make there. Most towns will actually say specifically when they're regulating it is when it's a registered medical marijuana caregiver. I'm sorry, a medical marijuana cultivation facility is usually defined as a facility that's not at the residence of a caregiver, and then it's for registered caregivers. So it sort of makes that distinction.
We got a thumbs up from Ben, so it sounds like that answered the question. Amanda Lassard?
Do you think, you know, given our experience with the executive orders for remote participation of board and committee meetings, that we'll eventually see a more successful change to statute to allow for this to continue outside of a pandemic?
That's a really good question, and I've supported this for years. I'm glad that we've gotten a chance now to use it, and it's obviously been it's very successful in my view. I would like to see it continue, at least in some limited cases, at a minimum. I can tell you that at least one entity is likely to propose or support a bill to make it permanent. That's the Maine School Board Association that I'm aware of. And I know the Maine Municipal Association is aware of that position, so I'm hoping that they would also support it as well. But groups like your groups, I think, if this, and I know the bill will undoubtedly be offered. So the question is if you know, groups like your groups or other groups that have an opinion about that, I think it's going to be important to weigh in on it. I do think it's a good option, and to have even in normal times. And there are particular things I think would just be easy to allow if the legislature wants to tiptoe into it. For example, executive sessions. It's never made sense to me why an executive session with a town council needed everyone in the same room when people aren't allowed to be there anyway, except for the town council. Because the whole point of, you know, public meetings is so people can see and hear and watch what you're doing. But executive sessions are already obviously closed to the public. So that seems to me an easy one to make permanent. But I'd like to see, and I'm seeing my own personal view here, I'd like to see it continue. It does provide flexibility, particularly in some really small towns where they have a hard time getting people together. People might be traveling, people might be sick, and it allows, you know, obviously people to participate, have these board meetings go on. You do have to be careful to make sure that there are safeguards to members of the public. But what I've seen actually is that more people are participating in these meetings than when they were live. It's much easier just to log in from your living room and watch what's going on than go down to town hall at night. So participation is up around the whole state from town meetings, from what I've been hearing.
Thanks.
Anyone else? Not seeing anyone pop up. Jared, do you have anything that you want to reflect on before we end?
Samantha?
Sorry? Yeah?
I do have, I'm sorry, I'm just turning my right. This is a question. It's not a current case law question, but I'm woefully out of date with a lot of case law right now, but I'm dying to know where things are at with signage, because that big kerfuffle with the whole signage, that you can't regulate anything that's in a sign, on a sign, around a sign, you know, it rubbed me the wrong way. And I'm just really curious to know where things are at in terms of signage regulation right now.
Well, that's a good question. That was obviously that discussion, at least in my practice, has sort of died down a bit in that area. That was clearly a lot of discussion when the U.S. Supreme Court made its finding. I think it was 2015. It was Reed versus the town of Gilbert, Arizona, I think you're talking about, and really said, you know, signage has to be content neutral. Signage ordinances have to be content neutral. And so it still does come up. I'll be working with a town from time to time that just has not yet amended their ordinances, and there's still some are out there that haven't. And you know, usually when we find them, we catch them and we start to work together to change it. But a lot of towns actually did do some work amending the ordinances in the wake of Reed. MMA did some work outreach, I think, with some communities on that too. And some of the private law firms who work with towns did some of that. But I haven't heard a lot. I haven't heard a lot of cases brought under that yet. I think towns are sufficiently scared to do something about it. There could be significant in that town, and I don't have it in front of me, but I was at the International Municipal Lawyers Association a few years ago, but the town of Gilbert had significant expenses as a result of that case. And so that really scared a lot of towns into doing something about it and to change their ordinances to be content neutral. But there hasn't been a lot of litigation, at least that I'm aware of.
Are there still, I mean, there probably are, but there's still towns just that didn't make any changes as a result of that?
I
feel like that's, since there hasn't been any follow-up, you know, nobody else has really put that one to the test or, you know, made
right.
it go anywhere, that it's just an interpretation and everybody's reacting. It seems the reaction was a little premature without really working through those details, but, yeah.
Yeah, there's still some towns that haven't, and for various reasons, some towns, you know, town meeting towns are just, you know, a little harder sometimes to make ordinance amendments. Some towns just, for whatever reason, didn't get the memo on it. And so it's new to that, you know, the issue is new, where we'll get the question still as a town where and it's around this time of year. It's because it usually comes up in political context. Someone has a huge flag, right? And it violates the flag size ordinance or something like that. And it's almost always political. And what we typically say, if the ordinance really would likely be considered unconstitutional under Reed, is that they should probably not enforce it. Because they could subject themselves to litigation around that. So, but the U.S. Supreme Court was very clear. So there's really not much gray area to me anymore. Ordinances have to be content neutral. You can't have categories that treat different uses or different types of speech differently. And so you have to, you know, they should be written in a way that there's wall signs and banner signs and temporary signs, not real estate signs and yard sale signs and that sort of thing. The one area I would say, Amanda, and it's not a good answer, but where I've seen it come up, the one area I've seen it come up is that municipalities continue to try, that the municipalities that have opted into marijuana establishments continue to put in their ordinances, they don't want to see pictures of a marijuana leaf or the word marijuana. You'll see that in these sign ordinances, and I usually recommend that they take that out. That there's a First Amendment issue there. You're telling that it's clearly content-based, right? I mean, it's specific to a word or a picture. And in this case, a name, that is legal if you've opted in to have those. So I've said you should not do that and just defer to the state law, because the state laws do have some regulatory provisions around signage for marijuana, and just I sort of safer to defer to that, but not prohibit certain words or phrases and things like that.
I see Matt's hand up.
I do, and that's it's going along the same sort of line of questions, and I was going to say essentially the same thing you just said, Phil, was on some of those things like political signs, you know, like the city of Augusta, our approach and in agreement with our city attorney is, you know, just defer to the state law. If the state wants, if the state wants to use the term political sign and regulate political signs, and the only way you can tell it's a political sign is by looking at it, then let somebody fight the state and simply say, you know, we're not, that's not our, our law, it's not our regulation. The one that I continue to be challenged by is sort of the real estate sign, because yes, you can say temporary, but then are you saying that somebody could only have a sign out on their lawn for 2 months or 3 months?
Right.
What if the house doesn't sell? That's the one area that I haven't quite figured out how to crack that nut on.
Yeah, that's a tricky one. I've seen some language, I just don't have it off the top of my head, where, you can kind of write around that. You see it also, the other area you see it is sort of like the temporary contractor signs when there's work being done. And so you could have temporary signs for activities, and I'm not going to do it justice out in front of me, but there, people have tried to be creative in the way that you regulate that, like properties for sale, temporary signs when properties are for sale. So you're not regulating the content of the sign itself, but it's attached to the, to a use that's going on. That's one way that people try to thread the needle, but I'm not still sure if that would, you know, how that would look in a court either. But, yeah.
Tim, did I see your hand up?
Yeah, I don't often read planning law. It's not a subject I delve into much, but somehow this report came across my desk from September, the report on the 20th anniversary of the Religious Land Use and Institutional Persons Act, and I found it really quite interesting. I don't know that there are any cases in Maine, but I don't know if you there have been a lot of cases around the country, I gather, trying to regulate churches or mosques or synagogues and the locations of them. I don't know, Phil, if you have come across anything like that in Maine, but we have kind of a fragmented set of religions in this country now, and they seem to be fragmenting even more. And I'm curious how towns grapple with that, with what is a church and what is permitted.
Yeah, it doesn't come up very often. I mean, I see Jeff raise his hand because I was going to say the one that I'm aware of, like I think Ralupa was brought up in the context of a potential synagogue in Portland, I want to say. I don't know if they relied on the federal law or not, but I remember there was a case like that in Portland, but there's not a lot of litigation around it in Maine. I guess it's the short answer to that. I'm just, you know, conjecturing here, but I suspect we may see RLUIPA under this current U.S. Supreme Court interpret this law more frequently. Is the way I'll leave it. I think you'll see some cases come up, and we just saw in the context of a COVID restriction case. That's not RLUIPA, but sort of a burden on religious institutions. So, you know, in that case prohibits the implementation of land use regulations that impose a, quote, substantial burden on religious institutions. But yeah, it's a good point. It's an interesting, I think we'll watch that space, essentially, going forward.
Jeff?
Yeah, circling back to signs again, it's my understanding you can still regulate off-site advertising on signs, even under Reed versus Gilbert. Is that true?
Yeah.
You can say no ads.
Right. That's right. Yeah. And I wasn't going to go too much into the weeds of it, but there's a case called like Macromedia, which essentially says you can regulate commercial speech, a little more strictly than you can non-commercial speech. And so there are some distinctions there when you get into the commercial area, but the content neutrality issue still applies. So, but yes, there is that distinction.
Thanks.
I see Jim just put a link in the chat.
Yeah, thank you. I'll take a look at that.
All right, other questions? Jared, do you have any reflections on the year that before we close up shop here? Or advice going forward on our legislative work?
The legislative and policy committee has been, it's been a learning curve, a steep learning curve for me. But it's been a good one. And the committee is actively involved, and it's a really important group of Maine planners that anybody would be lucky to work with. So I feel like it was a privilege over the last 2 years to work with that group. And so I'll be serving as the at-large member for Southern Maine. I'll still be on the board. And I'll continue working with the committee, but I'm happy to pass the torch. That committee's a lot of work that others in the MAP group have taken on, and they know what I'm talking about. But I'm definitely happy to be done with that leadership opportunity for the time being.
Well, thank you so much for doing. You did a ton of work when you were doing that, and just really appreciate it. And Phil, you've given us some great information today, and we really appreciate your willingness to come and talk. It's such a great format to get quick updates in to figure out what we each would want to delve into more individually, and so it's really very nice of you to come and do that. Thank you.
No, happy to do it. Thanks for inviting me.
Any last words before we adjourn?
I do. Have a couple.
Okay.
A couple of quickies. I just wanted to make sure that folks who are looking for the credits, I only just submitted the CM for the CM credits this week. Carl said he was going to get right on it, but I just wanted to let everyone know it's in process. So you can follow up with me or with Carl if needed. I also, it was occurring to me too after we got going. I did want to mention, besides Phil volunteering to come and do this, but just again say that we're really grateful that he's been able to do this and that Bernstein Sure has been one of our greatest sponsors, honestly, in the last several years. They've been very consistent. And I just wanted to thank you guys for being able to support our conferences. It's been pretty crucial, and we really appreciate the support. That's all I got.
All right, great. It sounds like that's it for us today. So I'll see how successful I was at recording, and then assuming all went well, we'll make it available in case you wanted to see it again or for those of our colleagues who couldn't make it. And I think this may be my last MAP event as president, which is a little sad and a little happy all at the same time. Thank you, Amanda, for taking the torch and running with it. And thanks, everybody, for coming today.
All right. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.